This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā, tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Hi, kia ora, this is Sally Carlton with Speak Up Kōrero Tia radio show and podcast. Today's topic is Indian communities in Aotearoa, and this topic was prompted by the fact that the Christchurch City Council is currently hosting a photographic exhibition called Mauka, which means opportunity in Hindi. And this exhibition commemorates over a century and a quarter, a very, very long time, of Indian migration to New Zealand. If you're interested in checking it out, you can go and see the exhibition weekdays in the council foyer until the 24th of August. Here today to discuss Indian migration to and settlement in New Zealand, we've got three expert guests. Archana, perhaps we'll start with you. Archana Tandon, if you could please introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Archana Tandon from Indian Community, and I arrived in New Zealand Christchurch in 1990. And I've been very much involved with community ever since.
Archana has so many hats, I'm never sure what to put down when I speak about you, actually. And Jane Buckingham from the University of Canterbury History Department.
Oh, hello. I've been working in Indian history as a researcher and a student since I was 19 years old, and I won't say how old I am now. And I came to New Zealand in 20 years ago from Australia. And one of my most recent areas of research and interest has been in this area of indentured labour migration, but also more broadly Indian migration to New Zealand and Australia as well.
And you've recently co-edited a book called Indians and the Antipodes, which is a very poignant topic for this particular conversation.
Yes, we're very excited to myself and my colleague and friend Shekhar Bandopadhyay at Vic. He and I co-edited this book. It really brings together the most recent scholarship in this area of research, and we look not only at the recent migration of Indians, but to the much earlier migration of Indians to New Zealand and Australia, and it's a very neglected topic, actually.
And I suppose that's one of the benefits of exhibitions as well.
Yes, absolutely, because an exhibition enables people to have an immediate visual understanding of something of who the people were, what kind of lives they led, perhaps something of their aspirations. Also, often you'll find images will be in family groups or in a particular context of a home. So you also understand a lot from those images, a lot about who the person was, how they saw themselves in relation to others. Even if they're fairly we would say quite formal images, they can be very important. And in fact, some of these images relate to things like immigration passes and the kinds of restrictions in migration. Often an image was part of the condition, just like a passport for us. A photo was part of the condition for being allowed entrance to New Zealand or Australia for that matter. And those photos and images can themselves tell a lot, say a lot about who the person was and how they saw themselves in the world at that moment that they were coming to these very strange foreign countries of Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, very strange. And our final guest is Inspector Rakesh Naidu, my former colleague at the Human Rights Commission and Strategic Advisor of Race Relations there. Hi, Rakesh. Namaste.
Oh, namaste, and kia ora, Sally and Arch and Jane. Pleased to be on the program. And yeah, I'm currently on assignment at the Human Rights Commission as a Strategic Advisor of Race Relations, and my formal or substantive role is with the New Zealand Police.
Great, and you are also of Indian ethnicity once upon a time.
That's right. Just like with Indians that have traveled all over the world, my parents, I grew up in South Africa, and my parents came, my forefathers went to South Africa originally as indentured laborers.
There's a nice connection with your story there, Jane.
Yes, I don't know that nice is quite the term, but yes, it was a great privilege and pleasure to have Rakesh talk at the book launch in Wellington that we held just a month or so ago, and to bring this sort of deeper networked and connected history into this history of migration, because for every person who comes to New Zealand, they've left family behind, and sometimes the family is in India, but sometimes the family is in other what were then colonial contexts or indentured migration contexts. Or perhaps they left them behind because they'd left them on a shore somewhere as part of a sealing ship expedition. So there's a lot of connections between different countries, as well as just direct links between India and New Zealand or Australia.
Hmm. One of these countries that seems to be quite key in the story of Indian migration, that at least initially, is Fiji, as a stopping off point between India and New Zealand. And this might be a good point to kind of jump in and start talking about Indian migration to New Zealand in the very, very early days.
Okay, so one of the really exciting things that came out of this book, and it's going to be available through Oxford University Press, New Delhi, just a plug put in there. But one of the really exciting things that Todd Nakovich discovered in his research was that actually the first Indians in New Zealand landed in 1769, so linked to the migration of James Cook. I mean, James Cook's visit and Indian migration in New Zealand happens at the same time. And historically, the research that had been done tended to link migration with whaling ships and sealing ships, and to make it a much, much later date. So this is a really exciting piece of evidence. And he found this by looking at ships' logs and so forth. These were two gentlemen, men from Puducherry on the Tamil coast in South India, who came and became connected with the local Maori community, and followed, set a pattern that actually is a pattern that's repeated over and over again with Lascars. Indians would often come as crew on ships. They came as part of they often came on East India Company boats. And they often ended up playing a kind of intermediary role between the local Maori groups, whichever location, Ngāi Tahu, whichever tribe they were nearby, and the Europeans. So they have had an important role actually in establishing relationships between Pākehā and New Zealand Maori communities. And that's a mind-blowing thing to consider, because if you think that in the 1920s there were restrictions preventing Indians coming into New Zealand because they were seen as, you know, Asian and coloured and not wanted, and yet Indians had a role in that foundation of Pākehā stability and prosperity in New Zealand. So it's a very intriguing phenomenon. And the Fiji side of it, of course, you know, one reason that the restrictions don't come in until 1920 is linked to indentured migration and labour, because Fiji was a place where there was sugar cane grown, and there was a great desire for labour in that area, and indentured labourers were required. So there was no problem with having Indians coming through New Zealand or going to Fiji and part of the British Commonwealth countries when there was a labour requirement. But when that labour requirement became no longer needed, then suddenly they were persona non grata.
Yeah, they were mainly Fiji Indians were sugarcane farmers. Yeah, they came from East India and migrated to Fiji. And Fiji Indians here now, their forefathers, they were farmers in Fiji. That's what... Yeah,
exactly. And there's a later migration from Fiji to New Zealand because of the restrictions. Again, it's about restrictions in land ownership for Indians in Fiji. There's a very complex history behind this, but basically you're looking at the interference of colonialism and British colonial labour interests, which interfering in the histories of Fiji and India and all the countries in between. And these are the consequences. These migration patterns are linked to those colonial interventions.
Certainly a different way of looking at migration, which nowadays we always think of as being a free choice most of the time, don't we? So that's talking about Indian migration very, very early on. Now, if we look at New Zealand today, Indian community is the second largest Asian group in New Zealand after Chinese. And this population has really increased since the 1980s or so. Rakesh and Archana, you're both kind of part of that wave of migration. What are some of the reasons that are attracting Indians to New Zealand today and in the recent past?
As we know, India is overpopulated and underemployment. So at the moment, mostly students are coming. So education and better lifestyle is one of the driving force for the migration.
Yep. And Rakesh?
Yeah, the thing is, as with migration patterns around the world, there's so many different reasons for people coming. When we look at Indians that lived in former colonies, be it Fiji, even South Africa, largely changes of government, coups, feelings of safety, wanting to have security, find that looking at migrating to another country, and that's where we've seen migration come into New Zealand, from particularly Fiji post the coups, as well as from South Africa when you're looking at wanting greater opportunity and safety reasons, the way that New Zealand is perceived as a country that is safe. Also a country that is more open and welcoming, respects human rights, it's corruption-free largely, and they see it as a good destination. So I guess when you look at Indians as a whole, it's not one homogenous group. They are driven based on where they have settled over time, historical context, and then each making their choices, just as with other settlers that come to New Zealand, being driven by different reasons. And as Archana has said, in recent times, many Indians have come to New Zealand as a first port of contact via international students. But also, skilled migration has, I think, second only to Australia and the United Kingdom. Mm. It's now India as well. So there's also a big influx of skilled migrants. And this is driven for the same reasons that we see in other parts of the world, where people are wanting to move to a place with stable governments, a place that is seen as safe. Maybe the remoteness of New Zealand is attractive.
Mm. Rakesh, you mentioned international students, and international students from India in particular, I mean, generally, but particularly from India, are really increasing at the moment. And that's causing both pros and cons, and I'd appreciate a little bit of discussion around that if you guys are interested.
Yeah, we have different sorts, and they're all sorts. We do have students who come to university, and then we have these private institutions which have students coming as putting their foot in the door criteria. Somehow it doesn't team up with as providing education, quality education. That's how personally I look at it. Have come across so many of them where some of them are serious about education, some of them are not. We have got so many of those international private institutes closing up because of the reasons that they don't sort of meet the criteria for immigration or as an education provider, a quality education provider. So international students coming here, they see it as their first step towards a better future. That's how they take it. But whether it follows that path, not for everyone.
Yeah, the unfortunate truth.
And to add to that, the international education industry and agents selling products overseas have largely looked at students, where students have looked at an education in New Zealand as a pathway to employment and a pathway to settlement, rather than quality education and receiving an education and then going back to India. They really utilized it as a mechanism in order to travel to New Zealand for long-term settlement and or for employment. And I think that's been some of the messaging that needed to be realigned within the sector, where the sector focused on looking after students, attracting them here for the purpose of quality education. And then also if students wanted to stay on, then that skilled, the skills they would have would contribute towards the shortage of skills in New Zealand. I think the economic outcome that was originally planned by the sector, where it was used as a vehicle to assist us overcome the global financial crisis, a vehicle to boost the economy, and then you had courses that were just being offered along with working hours that wasn't, and an industry that really didn't have adequate oversight, led to consequences where expectations of what was being sold to students overseas didn't meet the expectations of then what was being provided in New Zealand. So a lot of work has been done in that area, and we see now with the new international student well-being strategy and the new education strategy, which is very much focused on looking after students but also providing quality education.
Yes, I think speaking from University of Canterbury, as a historian and as someone teaching history, we see a relatively small number of students coming from India because it's less of a vocational kind of degree. And it's often a challenge to find a kind of meeting point between the students' expectations and the requirements of a degree. And I think one of the challenges the students struggle with is often the big gap between their experience of education in India and then the requirements at undergraduate level at a university like Vic or at University of Canterbury, but also more so at the postgraduate degree. And I think I certainly find I'm part of the history department. I'm an associate professor in the history department, but also I'm currently director of New Zealand South Asia Centre. And we have a lot of inquiries from postgraduate students, particularly wanting to do a master's or more often a PhD. But it's very difficult for students to kind of bridge that gap. Unless they've been somewhere with an exceptional academic record in India. And I think what Rakesh says is very important, this sort of importance of communicating really clearly to students coming from India the kinds of expectations, the kinds of academic requirements, so that they don't come and then find they've bitten off more than they can chew. And certainly in history, for example, at Canterbury, we've put in place a sort of pre-enrolment processes so that students have, we can make sure that they really are clear about how to write a proposal and what their research is before we enrol them, just so that they don't have that experience of moving across from the other side of the world and maybe taking a loan out, because often the parents will take a big mortgage out and then finding they can't manage. It's a major ethical responsibility.
Certainly a good way of looking at it.
Also, you know, the other reason that we are seeing migration from India is that, you know, India has one of the youngest per capita populations in the world. You know, they're largely, there's some, I've got to figure out, get the exact figure, but there's the youth and the employed youth in India. There's really an abundance of youth, and they really, from an occupation perspective, they are looking overseas to see how they can get into good jobs and look at expanding their careers, just because the market in India is so limited. and the population is so great. And from a skilled labor perspective, we know that in New Zealand and other countries, and particularly Western countries, they have aging populations. And that's where the opportunity lies as well, to look at it as where we can get skilled labor that's coming, and for skill shortages in New Zealand, that there's obviously some sectors that require it. And having an overabundance of youth in India, young, wanting to travel, wanting to see the world, wanting to move their families to better areas and better economies, then they are looking to travel overseas.
Well, talking about young people and international students, we might have our first song break, and I'd like to say thank you to Tanu and the University of Canterbury Global India Reach Group, which gave me these song suggestions. We've got Jai Ho from Slumdog Millionaire.
aja jinde shami gaane ke tal chazri wale neele aasmaan ke tal jai ho jai ho jai ho jai ho jai ho
jai ho ratti sachi maine नच नच कोयलों पे रात बिताई है अखियों की नींद मैंने फूकों से उड़ा दी गिन गिन तारे मैंने उंगली जलाई है
जमाल मलिक गरमा गरम चाय देने वाला फ्रॉम मुंबई लेट्स प्ले कौन बनेगा करोड़पति
Harimai, welcome back to Speak Up Korero Tia. We're discussing Indian communities in Aotearoa. And Rakesh, you've got some stats for us about the youthfulness of India's population.
That's right, Sally. India has more than 50% of its population below the age of 25 and more than 65% below the age of 35. And it is expected that in 2020, which is 2 years from now, the average age of an Indian will be 29 years. And this is compared to, say, the average age in China is 37, or in Japan, which is 48. And when we look at New Zealand, which has an aging population as well, we can see that there is, when we talk about migration to New Zealand, we see a lot of international students. And when we try to look at the underlying reasons, we have a huge numbers of youth in India that are looking for opportunities in other parts of the world.
One thing that always interests me, and we've touched on this a little bit, is as soon as you leave India, you become an Indian. if you're in a new country. Whereas if you are in India, you might identify more closely with a region or a language or a religion or a particular family group, whatever it might be. And I'm interested in hearing your experiences about how do you adopt, navigate, change, whatever it might be, these various identities.
Personal experience, yep. While I was in India, never thought about these different areas and identities. I was in North. For me, anything beyond North was all South India. When I arrived here, and after a while here, I saw more of those groups. Even South Indians have got different groups, Malayalis and Tamils and Telugus, and you can't actually call them all South Indians because some of them will feel offended. No, I'm a Malayali speaking person, or I'm a Telugu speaking person, so I'm not just a South Indian. So I think my awareness of that navigation has increased here over the years more than when I was back home.
I think that's so interesting, isn't it? Change the context and then it changes how you approach it or see it.
Yeah. It's like...
Yeah, no, I've seen a very... and the same as Archana, actually. In New Zealand, we do find that there's quite a wide diaspora of Indians.
Mm.
And within there, but they do tend to identify with particular groups or particular areas that they've come from.
Yeah.
And set up organizations or institutions or services in and around that.
Yeah.
Be it within, either along religious lines or around cultural lines or from even the states people come from.
Mm.
And navigating that can be a challenge. And it's also both a celebration of that diversity.
That's right.
But also, I think, the importance of how we then develop a Kiwi identity. How do we develop a New Zealand identity in and amongst that? So it's about retaining and being proud of being Indian and where you come from and working within communities that are from your region and from your areas, but then also developing our New Zealand and Kiwi identity. And within that New Zealand identity, we know that New Zealand has a recognition of the bicultural relationship and the bicultural foundation of New Zealand. And now that we are becoming more multicultural, our society is definitely more multicultural. It's about how we bridge that conversation and how we widen that conversation about people settling in New Zealand and engaging and respecting one another.
Rakesh, do you identify as an Indian New Zealander?
Yeah, I do. I identify myself as a New Zealander first and foremost.
Uh-huh.
And I identify myself. Somebody asks me, "What's the ethnicity?" I say, "Yes, I'm Indian. So I'm a Kiwi Indian, Indian Kiwi."
Yeah, it goes both ways, doesn't it? Like you come across people who would firstly ask you, "Where are you from?" Then you have to say, "Yeah, originally from India, but I've been here for 30 years." And they'll go, "Oh, you're a Kiwi then." So that's. Somehow I feel I have to make sure that I tell them that I have been here for that long so that they can relate me as a local. And most of the people, they do. Yeah, they'll just say, "Oh, you're a local." So it goes with how much time you've spent here, and that's the acceptance. That's my experience. That your acceptance comes, sort of acceptance for you comes with the time that you have spent here.
There is, and it all depends who asks you and in what context, because when you engage with a lot of people, there is this feeling that sometimes, if you say, if you identify based on your ethnicity, then I think you're not proud to be a New Zealander or you're not... you're not committed to New Zealand.
Yes.
In some strange way that your allegiances lie elsewhere. But with globalization and settlement and multiple identities and multiple hats that people wear and families that live in different parts of the world right now, where you have extended family that can be living in other countries and naturalized. So definitely when you get asked the question, are you New Zealander, are you Indian, or who are you, what's your identity? Particularly for migrants or for people from minority communities, can be a real challenge for them sometimes.
Mm, yeah.
And they feel that there's no right answer that you can give to satisfy people, apart from saying, yes, I am a New Zealander, I'm committed to New Zealand, I'm proud of being a New Zealander.
Yeah. It's the exposure that people have got. As you say, Rakesh, that depends who's asking you. So it depends how much exposure they've got with others and other ethnicities. So, sometimes people would just ask you by the look for it, sort of, oh, you don't look like Indian, you look like Greek or Egyptian.
Yeah, when I was appointed to a role in Canterbury, I remember it was on television, carried by the press as well. It basically said African appointed to the role of Asian liaison officer. So they basically were saying that because I was born in Africa, I'm African, and I'm not Asian. And there was this whole discussion and debate about whether I could actually do the role or not, because there's this perception that because I was born in Africa, I couldn't understand engaging with Asian people. So there was this complexity about trying to deny your, real historical journey where your family had to undergo so much of trial and tribulation, being taken to Africa, and you have a strong connection with Africa, and then being told that, having an Indian identity, moving to New Zealand, having a New Zealand identity, and then in some way, people forcing you to disassociate yourself or to pick one over the other, which I think it's much more complex than just choosing one and sticking to it.
Jane, have you come across this in your research? People in the past having similar types of identity questions?
Yeah, I was thinking of this as Naidu and Archana were speaking. I'm thinking of the plantation labourers in Fiji. One of the things that Brij Lal has written extensively on, and so have other scholars, is that the process of migration from India to Fiji meant that many people who normally would live very separately, so they may be different religious communities, different caste communities, from different parts of India, would often be thrown together in the same boat. And literally in the same boat, and had to eat the same food, had to live very close together, couldn't observe the normal practices they would have with their religious practice or and so forth. And that this actually helped to create a new kind of identity for many of the Fijians who ended up in, I'm sorry, many of the Indians, I beg your pardon, who ended up in Fiji. And this idea of a kind of the jahajis, these people who traveled together on this boat, becoming a new kind of community, is a very strong theme in narratives of indentured experience in Fiji. And I would expect it would be similar in other places. But you do find this north-south distinction is very strong in Fiji as well. It's also very strong in India. You go to India, and I spend a lot of time in South India. That's my main area. And my friends in the north go, I go south, I'm in a foreign country, I can't understand the language, the people are so different. And it's like me going to Germany that it's similar but very different. And that sense of alienation is quite strong. And I always find this quite bizarre, but I can see where they're coming from. The language groups are completely different. There's so many different cultural paradigms. And it was the same in indentured locations, so that in Fiji, for example, the the South Indians who were later in this process, the Indians who went largely from the East first and the Northeast, but the South Indians who went later, and they struggled terribly because they couldn't connect with the existing communities of Indians in Fiji. So the colonial model was, well, they're all Indians and they're all labourers, so they all get treated the same. But within the cultural patterns and within the communities developing, there were still strong distinctions between North and South, and I think that's probably the strongest distinction you see, to the extent that the South Indians found it almost unbearable, the sense of isolation and dislocation, and they couldn't get support from the people who were already there because they felt so different. There were very high suicide rates among the South Indian indentured labourers. So it just shows how identity is something that is both fluid but also very deeply felt and deeply experienced.
I think it's also people's knowledge of India. You know, India is made up of 29 states. It's, 1.3 billion people. There's, hundreds of languages. There's lots of various religions. I mean, it's the same place, the same when people talk about Africa. They look at, where they think of Africa as just one big place. There's more than 50 different countries in Africa. And then within tribes and sub-tribes. So it's very easy just for people to look and think, you're Indian, and they expect all Indians to kind of know one another or be homogeneous. And sometimes it's quite, when you're trying to explain it to somebody or trying to make them understand identity, it can be a real challenge because their identity is very much fixed in their own point of reference. And I think that's why it's easier sometimes when we engage not easier, but I think that's where we find, I guess, much similarity with Maoridom and understanding Iwi and Hapu and, tribal affiliation. There is, in one sense, a closer connection in that frame.
Yes, one thing that came out of this book that we've published was the range of experience of migrants, Indian migrants to New Zealand as well, but also the difference in experience between men and women. And I think that gender and also what we didn't look at so much in this collection but is something that is very pressing, and you see it in more contemporary debate on migration, is the role of young people and their experience in this migration, so that they, their parents may have one set of values, they come to a new country, they want to preserve the best of the old, and then the children are going to school in New Zealand and they're having different experiences, and sometimes there are tensions, and that the plurality of identity is something that goes through generations, even with one family, and also will be something that is expressed through the experience of a woman at home versus a husband going to work. And many of the stories and the people you meet, for example, in the pages of this book are women who had very important roles in keeping the family together, providing connections with the local community, getting to know the neighbours, and becoming kind of the bridge between the old world they had lived in and the new world that they were coming to terms with. And often those neighbourly gestures that women are able to kind of, those little neighbourly gestures, talking about the children, maybe borrowing something, taking some food, those little things often made such a difference in beginning that step of connection and understanding between different societies and communities.
Yeah, it's like living between two cultures. That's what it is for the next generation.
Well, I think we'll have our second song, which is Rang De Basanti, also another Hindi movie. I should say Bollywood movie, probably. And then I think we'll pick up this idea of settlement and integration and what enables it, what can hinder it, and is it actually what people will want?
Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling वतन की थोड़ी सी धूल मेरी धरती की मेरे वतन की थोड़ी सी खुशबू बाराई से मस्त पवन की थोड़ी सी धोंकने वाली दग 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 सांसे जिनमें हो जुनू जुनू वो बूंदे लाल लहू की ये सब तू मिला मिला ले फिर रंग तू खिला खिला ले ये सब तू मिला मिला ले फिर रंग तू खिला खिला ले और मोहे तू रंग दे पसंदी यारा मोहे तू रंग दे पसंदी मोहे 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 मोहे तू रंग दे पसंदी
बिस्मिल दा संदेश है कि लखनऊ जाने वाली ट्रेन जो जिसमें फिरंगियों ना पैसा जानता है उसे हम काकुरी में लूटेंगे काकुरी कबाब खाते खाते लूटेंगे हाँ और उन पैसों से हम खरीदेंगे बम क्या खरीदेंगे बम
तू नहीं हटता हाँ उन्हें दूध देना बंद कर दे
सपने रंग दे अपने रंग दे खुशियां रंग दे गम भी रंग दे नस्लें रंग दे फसलें रंग दे रंग दे धड़कन रंग दे सरगम रंग दे सूरत रंग दे दर्पण मोहे मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती यारा मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती थोड़ी सी धूल मेरी धरती की मेरे वतन की थोड़ी सी खुशबू बाराई से मस्त पवन की थोड़ी सी धोंकने वाली धक 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 सांसे जिनमें हो जुनू जुनू वो बूंदे लाल लहू फिर रंग तू खिला खिला ले ये सब तू मिला मिला ले फिर रंग तू खिला खिला ले और मोहे तू रंग दे पसंदी यारा मोहे तू रंग दे पसंदी
बिस्मिल दा संदेश लखनऊ जाने वाली ट्रेन उसमें ओए छोटू सुन तेनु बिस्मिल दा संदेश मिल गया
है
नहीं तो सुन 8 दिन बाद जो ट्रेन लखनऊ जा रही है उसे हम काकोरी में लूटेंगे बड़े पैसे जा रहे हैं अंग्रेजों के उसमें लूटेगा
नहीं
पर यार उसे हथियार खरीदेंगे क्या खरीदेंगे
हथियार
हाँ शाबाश जा
धीमी आज भी तू जरा इश्क चढ़ा थोड़े झरने ला थोड़ी नदी मिला थोड़े सागर ला थोड़ी गागर ला थोड़ा छिड़क छिड़क थोड़ा हिला हिला फिर एक रंग तू खिला खिला
मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती यारा मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती
बिस्मिल का संदेश है लखनऊ जाने वाली ट्रेन जिसमें फिरंगियों का पैसा जाता है उसे हम 7 दिन बाद काकोरी में लूटेंगे और उन्हीं पैसों से आएंगे हमारे हथियार
बस्ती रंग दे हस्ती रंग दे हस हस रंग दे नस नस रंग दे बचपन रंग दे चौबन रंग दे अब देर न कर सचमुच रंग दे रंगरेज मेरे सब कुछ रंग दे थोड़ी सी धूल मेरी धरती की मेरे वतन की थोड़ी सी धूल मेरी धरती की मेरे वतन की थोड़ी सी खुशबू बाराई से मस्त पवन की थोड़ी सी धोंकने वाली धक 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 सांसे जिनमें हो जुनू जुनू वो बूंदे लाल लहू की ये सब तू मिला मिला ले फिर रंग तू खिला खिला ले मोहे मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती यारा मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती मोहे मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती मोहे मोहे तू रंग दे बसंती मोहे रंग दे बसंती बसंती रंग दे बसंती बसंती रंग दे बसंती बसंती रंग दे बसंती
ਦੇ ਬਸੰਤੀ ਬਸੰਤੀ
ਮੋਹੇ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਬਸੰਤੀ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਬਸੰਤੀ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਬਸੰਤੀ ਯਾਰ
Welcome back to Speak Up Quartet Tier. We're with Archana Tandon, Jane Buckingham and Rakesh Naidu talking about Indian communities in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I think we're going to pick up this idea that Jane was just talking about in the end of the final segment, living between two identities. And this idea of integrating into New Zealand society, is it something that is in fact wanted, or is it something that comes with the territory almost of being a migrant? And if so, what can hinder and what can help?
It comes with it. That's what I feel. And we have done a bit of research on that with Multicultural Council, with Women Council. We have had a survey of living between two cultures for women. And yeah, when you come here, for some, they don't have kids. They have kids here. For some, they come with the kids. So it's mainly it's for the next generation and for the present ones who come here, because we have that identity that we come here with, and we don't want to give it up or let it go. But at the same time, we have to integrate in the new country and with the people. Gel with the people. On personal note, with me, I came as a newlywed bride here. I came here within 2 weeks of getting married, and that too in Lincoln, a very small community. So as Jane mentioned, those neighborly gestures, we used to live next to Hillier's Bakery, and the grandma of the house, wintertime, she bought pot of soup, pumpkin soup. That was the first time I had pumpkin soup. So she knocked on the door and bought pumpkin soup because I was home alone. So those things, and I personally, I felt being in a smaller place helped a lot because it was smaller community, it was close-knit, and we haven't moved out of Lincoln at all. We have been there for 30 odd years ever since. We just love it. Yeah, but at the same time, with having kids, our kids are finding that, especially our son, he found that he had that experience of, he calls himself, I'm a Kiwi, I'm a New Zealander, but one look at him, people won't say he's a Kiwi because they go by looks. He looks like an Indian. So he had that sort of bit of torn between the two cultures experience that within school he had to go through. You being an Indian, you have to do these things. But he didn't know that he had to do these things because he was brought up like a local. That's what we would, he has his values from home, but at the same time, he's been brought up in New Zealand society as a New Zealander. So yeah, he's a young fellow now. He understands now, but he has, both of our kids have taken that paths of living between the two cultures.
I think it's so admirable, the kids who navigate that challenge, and so enriching, but must be so difficult.
Yeah, that's what we are saying, that we have to start from school. Little ones have to be aware of what it's like, and they have to be taught or made aware of other cultures as well. That's what multicultural society is. But yeah, we are getting better now.
Rakesh, I always think of you giving a presentation at some point, probably at a Human Rights Commission conference, and giving a really long mihi in te reo, and everybody being so impressed with that. And that for me is a really exciting sign for me, looking at your kind of settlement journey. It might not be for you, but that kind of mastery of te reo and all that that implies. As someone looking at you, I think that that's a really cool sign of you becoming so comfortable and familiar with the culture here.
Yeah, I think when you move anywhere, it doesn't matter where you move in the world and where you live, be it in the suburbs or, there is a personal responsibility in my view, to reach out to people, to share with them, because you knew you're coming into an area, and I think that it's a shared responsibility, but you got to take some responsibility, and that means understanding the local history, having an appreciation that you are new to this to the area, and making an effort in order to integrate and to settle, but retaining your sense of identity as well. I remember when I joined the police as a vegetarian, somebody who didn't smoke, who didn't drink. you know, there was it was a huge shock, I think, for many of my colleagues who were quite used to, you know, relaxing and having a beer. And I guess in one sense, it's when people do relax, it's like a common trait. We'll sit down and have a barbecue and we'll get to know one another. But I was very happy to engage in that. It's just that I wouldn't eat meat and I wouldn't drink alcohol. But people would be very accepting of that difference. But it wasn't a barrier for us having a conversation and getting to know one another. So I think that that's where that partnership does come in, where you've got to make an effort in order to understand the language, to show people that you also have your own culture and your own identity, but you explain that to them. So I found it really valuable, no matter where I've gone, just as you would as a tourist. You want to go somewhere, you want to learn and experience. You just don't want to stay locked up in a room looking at the television. You want to go out and experience the food, experience the people. So I've really enjoyed that. And what I continue to champion and continue to do, even in my work, is to look at opportunities where people that are new to New Zealand can engage more with local history, the local language, and it only enriches you and really positions you well for successful settlement. And where we have seen programs that have connected Maori with newer communities, or newer communities in their local neighborhoods with their neighbors, these have been proven to be very successful. And if anything, that's where some support from either local government or central government can always contribute to that, but also personal responsibility to making sure that people do get out, get to know other people.
Well, just to finish up then, that's a nice note, I think, and it kind of brings us full circle to what you were discussing at the very beginning, Jane, about Indians facilitating connectivity between Pākehā and Māori cultures way back when. Is there any final comments any of you would like to make about the theme of Indian communities in New Zealand?
Embrace the diversity. Celebration, yeah.
Yes, I think it's not to be frightened. It's nothing to be frightened of. And the connections and the complementarities, the friendships, the mutual understandings, all these are things that flow from meeting people who can seem at first rather different, but once you start to communicate and share a bit of food and maybe some music, then you find that actually you have a lot more in common than not. And that's really the fundamental of human life, isn't it? That we have probably a lot more in common than we ever imagined.
Rakesh, any final words of wisdom?
I just want to underscore that exactly that point, that we have so much more in common than people do realize. And once you start that conversation and you take the time to get to know one another, you'd find that you just the sheer humanity of reaching out and engaging with another person just enriches your life so much. And that's that commonality that we need to embrace and not just look at it from a, you know, migration perspective or race perspective or social status perspective, but just connecting on a human level brings so much of value and just strengthens one's life in a much better way.
Right, thank you. That was very beautiful. Thank you very much. Jane, you want to add something?
Oh, no. And thank you, Sally, for bringing together all these people. It's been lovely having this conversation.
Great. Well, I always really enjoy whatever we talk about, but it's so nice to bring people together. Just what we were talking about, actually. Kia ora. And for those of you listening, don't forget we're on Facebook and on Twitter, and there are transcripts available.